You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Order, order.
Good evening, this is Susan Hume at Westminster. Tonight, the Prime Minister takes FIFA to task for banning Scottish and English footballers from wearing poppies on Armistice Day.
Before they start telling us what to do, they jolly well ought to sort their own house out.
Also tonight, the Iraq Inquiry Chairman, Sir John Chilcot, is asked if the evidence supported the case for war in Iraq.
The answer to that is no.
And the MP who replaces Joe Cox, who was murdered, makes her maiden speech.
Batley and Spen will not be defined by the one person who took from us, but by the many who give.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But first, the Prime Minister has called the World Football Governing Body, FIFA, outrageous for banning players from wearing poppies on armbands at the forthcoming Scotland-England match. The World Cup qualifier is due to be played on Armistice Day, but FIFA has underlined its ban on players wearing any political, religious or commercial messages on their kit. The issue was raised at Prime Minister's Question Time by Labour's Steve McCabe.
Has the Prime Minister spotted the ludicrous refusal by FIFA, the Footballing Federation, to let our players wear poppies at the forthcoming Scotland-England game? Will he tell the respective associations that in this country we decide when to wear poppies? And they'll be wearing them at Wembley?
The Prime Minister was aware of the controversy and she had a view.
I think the stance that's been taken by FIFA is utterly outrageous.
Yeah!
Our football players want to recognise and respect those who have given their lives for our safety and security.
And given the controversy surrounding FIFA over allegations of corruption, she wasn't finished there.
I think a clear message is going from this House. We want our players to be able to wear those poppies. And I have to say to FIFA that before they start telling us what to do, they jolly well ought to sort their own house out.
At first, it seemed as though the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, was going to ask about the film industry.
Could I recommend the Prime Minister supports British cinema? And takes herself along to a cinema to see a Palme d'Or winning film, I, Daniel Blake. And while she's doing so, perhaps she could take the Work and Pensions Secretary with her, because he described the film as monstrously unfair and then went on to admit that he'd never seen it.
I, Daniel Blake is Ken Loach's latest film about benefits claimants living on the edge. Jeremy Corbyn criticised the system of benefits sanctions where people have their welfare cut if they're deemed to have broken the requirements on looking for a job.
I'll tell the Prime Minister what's monstrously unfair. Ex-servicemen like David Clapson dying without food in his home due to the government's sanctions regime. It is time that we ended this institutionalised barbarity against often very vulnerable people.
Theresa May insisted she didn't want those in need to go without.
Of course it's important that in our welfare system we ensure that those who need the support that the state is giving them through that benefit system are able to access that.
But she pointed to the working people who pay taxes that fund welfare, saying the system had to be fair to them too.
That is why we need to have work capability assessments. It's why we need to have sanctions in our system. Now, the Right Honourable Gentleman has a view that there should be no assessments, no sanctions and unlimited welfare. I have to say to him that the Labour Party is drifting away from the views of Labour voters. It's this party that understands working class people.
The SNP Westminster leader, Angus Robertson, was worried about tax avoidance and crime. He pointed to a financial vehicle called a Scottish Limited Partnership, which he said had been implicated in money laundering and organised crime.
It is now a matter of public record that SLPs have acted as fronts for websites peddling child abuse images and that they have been parts of major corruption cases in Ukraine, Uzbekistan, Latvia, Moldova, and include the arms industry.
The Prime Minister said the National Crime Agency had been created to tackle just that sort of criminality. Later, there was a question about the British gymnast Lewis Smith. The four-time Olympic medalist has been given a two-month ban by British Gymnastics for appearing to joke about Islam in a video which was leaked to the media. He's apologised, but the Conservative Charles Walker was confused.
When people make fun of Christianity,
in this country, it rightly turns the other cheek. When a young gymnast, Lewis Smith, makes fun of another religion widely practiced in this country, he is hounded on Twitter by the media and suspended by his association. For goodness sake, Mr. Speaker, this man received death threats and we have all looked the other way. So my question to the Prime Minister is this: what is going on in this country? Because I no longer understand the rules.
Well, Theresa May said a balance needed to be found. We valued freedom of speech, but we valued tolerance of others too.
We also value tolerance in relation to religions. This is one of the issues that we've looked at in the counter-extremism strategy that the government has produced. I think we need to ensure that, yes, it is right that people can have that freedom of expression, but in doing so, that right has a responsibility too. And that is a responsibility to recognise the importance of tolerance to others.
The Prime Minister there. Now, Sir John Chilcot finally produced his report into the Iraq war this summer. In the end, it ran to more than 2.5 million words and spanned almost a decade of government decisions. Having had 3 months to weigh up the findings, senior MPs finally got the chance to talk to Sir John about the conclusions he'd reached. Alicia McCarthy was watching.
British troops were part of an international coalition led by the United States, which invaded Iraq in March 2003. By the time they left, a total of 179 British service personnel had been killed and tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians had died. Arguments in the run-up to the invasion centred on whether or not Iraq possessed chemical and biological weapons and had the capability to use them. When he appeared before the senior MPs who make up the liaison committee, its Conservative chairman, Andrew Tyrie, asked Sir John Chilcot how severe the threat was at the time.
In your view, in sum, did we need to go to war to protect Britain from an imminent threat?
Not in March 2003 is my shortest possible answer.
Andrew Tyrie asked if a reasonable person looking at the evidence at the time would have reached the same conclusion.
If you're posing that question with regard to a statement of an imminent threat to the United Kingdom...
I am.
..then in that case, I have to say, no, there was not sufficient evidence to sustain that belief objectively at the time.
Sir John said Tony Blair's description of the threat from Saddam Hussein had been the best possible inflection of the evidence and something he'd put in advocates' terms. Another Conservative, Julian Lewis, said he'd been in Parliament in 2003 and voted for the war, a decision he now regretted. He wondered...
For what primarily do you blame Tony Blair about the way in which he took the country to war and from what do you absolve him?
Sir John said this had been one of the most crucial judgments, if not the most crucial, since 1945. As for Tony Blair...
I absolved him from a personal and demonstrable decision to deceive Parliament or the public, to state falsehoods, knowing them to be false. That, I think, he should be absolved from. However, he also exercised his very considerable powers of advocacy and persuasion rather than laying the real issues and the information to back the analysis of them fairly and squarely in front of either Parliament or indeed the public.
MPs wondered if Tony Blair's famously informal sofa-style government had an impact on the way decisions were made. Labour's Ian Wright wondered if power was becoming increasingly consolidated in one person, the Prime Minister.
Is it almost, you know, the 21st century equivalent of Louis XIV, I am the state?
Sir John recalled taking evidence from Tony Blair's Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw. The inquiry had asked him...
How was it that the Cabinet, members of the Cabinet, other than Robin Cook, and to a lesser extent, I suppose, Clare Short, did not provide more challenge and insist on debate and insist on information?
The answer that came back was quite simple.
Tony Blair had, as leader of the opposition, rescued his party from a very dire political predicament. And he'd done it again afterwards as Prime Minister. And I had the sense from Mr. Straw's reaction that he had achieved a personal and political dominance, which was itself overriding the, if you like, the doctrine of collective cabinet response.
The power of patronage held back proper discussion.
Patronage particularly, perhaps. yes, but also just sheer psychological dominance.
A Conservative, Sarah Wollaston, wanted to know if there were ways to counterbalance that dominance in future, with parliamentary committees or MPs being given a bigger role. For example...
Do you think that there's a case for Parliament being given clear, open access to the legal advice?
The legal advice given to Tony Blair's government by the then Attorney General was highly controversial. Sir John made clear he thought it should have been considered in more detail.
The Cabinet should have had formal written advice from the Attorney General and the opportunity to consider it around a table, and not simply to say, well, do you say it's OK? Yeah, it's OK. Oh, well, and move on. That was simply not... didn't begin, for, in my view, to be an acceptable way of deciding whether or not there was a sufficient legal base for us to participate in the invasion of a sovereign country.
So the committee asked, at the end of it all, what was the single most important lesson from the Chilcot inquiry? Sir John said it had been asked to look at 9 years of central government and it wasn't possible to pick out one thing.
If you press me very hard, though I will say, it was a failure to exert and exercise sufficient collective responsibility for a very big decision.
And added to that, there'd been a failure to scrutinise its conduct and implementation.
Alicia McCarthy reporting. You're listening to Today in Parliament here on BBC Radio 4 with me, Susan Hume. Still to come, a Conservative rails at his party for sidelining working class people.
Replacing Rupert from Kensington and Chelsea with Jemima from Kensington and Chelsea was not doing an awful lot for diversity in the House of Commons.
But first, Tracy Braben, the new MP for Batley and Spen, has made her maiden speech in the Commons with a tribute to her friend and predecessor, Joe Cox, who was murdered last summer. Tracy Braben, a former actor on Coronation Street, said Joe Cox had been an inspiration.
That day will stay with everyone in Batley and Spen for the rest of our lives. But Batley and Spen will not be defined by the one person who took from us, but by the many who give.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Philip Davis.
Rare applause in the Commons from Labour MPs. Her maiden speech came during a debate on police safety called by the opposition. Labour's Shadow Home Secretary, Diane Abbott, called for more investment in body-worn cameras for police officers.
Where this has been trialled elsewhere, we have seen a sharp reduction in complaints against the police, and there can be little doubt that the presence of a camera would lead to an improvement in behaviour by all parties in what are often stressful or even dangerous incidents.
The policing minister, Brandon Lewis, said that body-worn cameras were important tools, but it was up to chief constables to decide on their use. The Home Office did want more information, though, about assaults on police officers.
I can announce that from next year we are asking police forces to provide data on the number of assaults with injury on a police officer as part of their recorded crime data. Creating this new crime classification is an important step in providing a more complete picture of assaults experienced by police officers. This additional information will help chief officers to understand what is happening in their forces and to protect their officers and staff.
Brandon Lewis there. And the Director of Public Prosecutions in England and Wales, Alison Saunders, says she has real concerns about security and police arrangements following the UK's decision to leave the European Union. She told a Lords committee that the package of measures available to the UK as a member of the EU, including the European arrest warrant, was absolutely vital. Rachel Byrne reports.
The head of the Crown Prosecution Service in England and Wales was appearing before the Lords EU Home Affairs Committee, which is looking into future security and policing cooperation between the UK and the EU in the light of the referendum vote. Alison Saunders highlighted the importance of the European arrest warrant, an EU-wide system which replaced separate extradition arrangements between member states. It meant that, as she put it, we can get people back into this country within a matter of days, such as one of the failed bombers in the 21/7 London terror attack.
He went to Rome, we got him back to the UK within 51 days, whereas if you look at our non-European extraditions, they take significantly longer, sometimes years. So we're talking rather than days, it's months and years. So that would be one of my real concerns, is actually it's the speed.
She gave another more recent example of the importance of the European Arrest Warrant, or EAW.
There was a murder of an elderly couple took place. We know that the suspect fled. His car was found at Dover, just by the ferry going across to France. All our intelligence seemed to suggest that he was going to France and possibly on elsewhere. Because we put the EAW out on the SIS2 database, what we actually found out literally days later was he was in Luxembourg. There was no intelligence to tell us he was there. We wouldn't have even thought to look there. But it sort of transpired he was in Luxembourg, and again we were able to extradite him back to this country where he is currently standing trial.
Alison Saunders explained that the difference between the EAW and extradition agreements between just two countries, or bilaterals, was that the arrest warrant allowed EU member states to extradite their own nationals.
We have certainly seen in the last few years, I think it's up to 150 people coming back that wouldn't have done if it was under the bilateral.
But Lord Jay, a former ambassador and independent peer, said while the UK could extradite EU nationals, EU countries could also get hold of UK nationals.
I mean, one of the criticisms of the European arrest warrant, which I'm often reading the papers here, is not so much the Poles coming here, but the Brits going elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm right in saying that there are 20 or 30 cases a year of British citizens being extradited.
Lord Jay asked how many of those cases were unjustified. Alison Saunders said she couldn't give a figure on that.
We extradite just over 1,000 people a year from the UK out. Of that, less than 5% are UK nationals, which probably accords with your figure. Of course, what we have done since 2015 or 14 is put in some safeguards because of some of the concerns that you articulated.
There was, for example, a proportionality bar to stop British people being extradited for low-level offences. Lord Soley, a Labour peer, asked about the European Criminal Records Information System, which allows member states to exchange data on criminal convictions.
I mean, that seems to me a rather vital area. I take it you're saying that is a vital area,
yes,
to you,
yes.
Right? What if we don't have that, if as a result of coming out of the European Union we lose that right, what do we put in its place?
Would it need to be an international agreement with the EU, Lord Soley asked? Memorandums of understanding with individual states? Alison Saunders said that would be for the Home Office to negotiate.
Whether it can be done on an EU-wide basis, that would be the easiest, I would have thought, and the most sensible, because you get buy-in from all 27 countries. If you can't, then it would have to be done on a bilateral.
The Director of Public Prosecutions said it was about retaining access to existing databases after Brexit.
Rachel Byrne with that report. Now, the House of Lords has insisted on a measure to force media organisations which do not sign up to an approved regulator to pay the legal costs of victims in phone hacking cases. Now, the measure is already law, but it hasn't been put into action by the government. So, peers want to hold ministers' feet to the fire by introducing a similar clause into the Investigatory Powers Bill. Now, peers are in a standoff with the Commons, which threw the clause out yesterday. And ministers have announced a consultation on whether to go ahead with forcing the media to sign up. But the independent peer, Lady Hollins, accused the government of reneging on a cross-party agreement.
If you're going to risk a consultation that will expose you to extraordinary pressure from big media, then at least while you do so, please protect some small measure of access to justice for victims.
The former Deputy Prime Minister and Labour peer Lord Prescott was a victim of press phone hacking.
This is all step by step by step to get rid of what was recommended by Leveson. That's what it's really about.
But the former Labour Defence Minister Lord West said the Investigatory Powers Bill was crucial for the security of the nation.
I hear people saying, oh, that's not a problem, but all my experience of government, all my experience of life is that things suddenly crop up. And I would be much happier knowing this bill is put to bed because our nation will then be much safer.
For Labour, Lord Rosser questioned why the government was consulting on its own legislation based on a cross-party agreement and passed by Parliament.
Is this to be a precedent and to become a feature with the government holding regular public consultations on whether or not it should implement legislation passed by Parliament? Where will it all end?
The Deputy Leader of the Lords, Lord Howe, warned against holding up such an important security bill and defended the consultation on Leveson. But peers insisted on the change to the Investigatory Powers Bill by a majority of 29. It now goes back to the Commons. Now, the government's plans to cut the size of the House of Commons has come under fire from all parties. The SNP is outraged that the number of MPs is being reduced to 600, while the House of Lords has more than 800 members. Simon Jones reports.
Last month, proposals were released that would almost completely redraw the political map of Scotland, cutting the number of Scottish seats at Westminster from 59 to 53. The plans would introduce changes to the boundaries of all but three of the existing parliamentary constituencies. Similar plans have already been published for England, Wales and Northern Ireland. The changes form part of the government's plan to cut the number of MPs from 650 to 600 and equalise the number of voters for each seat. The Scottish National Party is strongly opposed to the changes, and one of its MPs, Chris Laws, prayed in aid the Speaker of the House of Lords.
We should listen to the new Speaker, who said only last week in the House of Lords, "I don't think that we can justify a situation where you have over 800 peers at the same time as you're bringing down the Commons to 600 MPs. Does the Minister agree?"
The newly elected Lord Speaker, Lord Fowler, said there is a certain irony that the Commons is due to fall in size while the House of Lords now numbers over 800. But the government has said that equalising the number of voters in each constituency will make elections fairer while cutting the cost of politics. The Cabinet Office Minister, Chris Skidmore, said the House of Lords could not keep growing indefinitely, but reform was not a priority in this Parliament.
And I'm amazed that the SNP think going forward that this is the issue that they want to campaign on. Why not campaign on education? Why not campaign on health? Why not campaign on the issues that matter to the Scottish people?
An answer that clearly infuriated the SNP's Ian Blackford.
What an outrage for democracy was that answer from the Minister. We've got the ridiculous situation that there are more unelected members from the House of Lords living in the Highlands of Scotland than there are MPs. Yet this government wants to cut the democratic representation. We will be left with three members of Parliament from half the landmass of Scotland in the Highlands. That's not democratic accountability. Cut the Lords, not MPs.
Chris Skidmore urged members to respond to the public consultation on the boundary changes in Scotland.
But when it comes to equalisation of seats, there are some seats in Scotland that are currently twice the size of another, and that historic injustice must be rectified.
A Conservative, Peter Bone, half agreed with the Minister, saying changes to the Lords were not a priority.
But neither is it a priority to reduce the size of the Commons. And as we are abolishing goodness knows how many MEPs and taking on their workload, should the government not look again at quite correctly equalising seats but keeping the same number of members of Parliament?
Mr Skidmore said that cutting the number of MPs would save £66 million during a five-year Parliament, and he was supported by the Conservative Charlie Elphick.
While it's absolutely right that there should be equal votes and we should cut the cost of politics in the House of Commons, does he not agree that it is absurd that in the House of Lords there are no SNP peers, yet 56 here, and there are 100 Liberal Democrat peers, but a pathetic rump of eight here? It shows that they need to rebalance the membership of the House of Lords.
But the Shadow Cabinet Office Minister, Labour's Andrew Gwynne, accused ministers of cutting the number of people elected at the ballot box while stuffing the House of Lords.
If this isn't a partisan process, and given Brexit, and the fact that we are removing 73 MEPs, isn't it now time to have a fresh review based on 650 seats in this place?
The Minister, Chris Skidmore, said the equalisation of parliamentary seats was first called for by the Chartists in 1838.
And it will be this government that is determined to deliver to ensure we have that historic wrong righted.
And Chris Skidmore repeated that reform of the Lords was not a priority for voters.
Simon Jones reporting. There were further complaints about how Parliament manages its affairs during a debate about changing working practices. It was prompted by a report called The Good Parliament, which made a range of recommendations such as gender quotas to increase the number of women MPs, scrapping Friday sittings and a new dress code. The SNP's Kirsty Blackman welcomed the report, saying that with a constituency 500 miles away and two preschool children, there were a lot of barriers in her way.
It's incredibly hard to do this job if you've got preschool children, particularly if you are tackling all the other issues that people like me are. So, you know, I'm so far from home. I'm also, you know, having to suddenly finance this role.
The report also suggested a concord between the parties to stamp out unacceptable and unprofessional behaviour.
Some of my colleagues, they've had their outfits commented on by male MPs. Now, that's not appropriate. People shouldn't be, you know, making odd comments about outfits. And I don't think that behaviour is tackled enough in the House of Commons.
A Conservative, Philip Davis, had his own ideas about how to improve diversity in the House of Commons.
Replacing Rupert from Kensington and Chelsea with Jemima from Kensington and Chelsea was not doing an awful lot for diversity in the House of Commons. Actually, replacing Rupert from Kensington and Chelsea with Jim from Newcastle actually would have done an awful lot more for diversity in the House of Commons than this sort of tokenistic approach to diversity, which only sees things in terms of simplistic diversity, i.e. gender or race.
He added that Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May had managed to get to the top without tokenistic claptrap. And back at Prime Minister's questions, the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn had begun with a welcome to a new member of the wider Labour family.
Mr Speaker, could I take this opportunity of welcoming Nisa Constance McGinn and hope that the evidently effective crash course in midwifery undertaken by my honourable friend, the member for St Helens North, isn't a sign to the government that we believe in downgrading midwifery training.
The Labour MP Conor McGinn had had to help his wife when she gave birth earlier than expected on their living room floor last Friday. He was advised about what to do over the phone with a 999 call handler. But the Prime Minister had obviously missed this news and thought Jeremy Corbyn was name-checking a new addition to his own family.
Can I congratulate the Right Honourable Gentleman on the birth, I understand, of his granddaughter? I'm sorry, in that case I'm completely missed.
Theresa May laughed a lot in embarrassment as she realised the baby was nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn. Before she'd stood up, she'd had a quick word with the former Chief Whip, Patrick McLoughlin. Eventually, she recovered enough to point the finger of blame.
In that case, Mr Speaker, can I just say that perhaps one should never trust a former Chief Whip?
Patrick McLoughlin made despairing, slicing gestures at his own throat. A colleague squeezed his shoulder. But it's quite a long time until the next reshuffle, and she may have forgotten by then. Which brings us to tonight's main news from Westminster again. The Prime Minister has called the World Football Governing Body, FIFA, outrageous for banning Scottish and English players from wearing poppies on Armistice Day. I'm Susan Hume. The editor was Christina Cooper, and that was Today in Parliament.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.